thank you for downloading Business Matters from the BBC World Service, on air 5 days a week at 9 a.m. Singapore time and 8 p.m. New York time.
It's 1 o'clock GMT. Hello, I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. We're connecting the time zones. Today we're live in Hong Kong and New York. Coming up on the programme, having another go. President Trump signs a new executive order banning travel from 6 mainly Muslim countries after the first ran into legal trouble. But will this version do any better?
There are still very profound questions, above all, about whether this is simply a prettied-up Muslim ban, as we say here in the States, lipstick on a pig.
Also, France's beleaguered centre-right candidate for the presidency gets the full backing of his own party, despite a growing scandal. But voters aren't convinced. And the art of the party, Singapore-style. That's Business Matters here on the BBC, coming up after the news.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. Senior members of the Trump administration have defended a new executive order banning travellers from 6 mainly Muslim countries as a vital measure to protect US national security. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, said the new order was designed to keep out terrorists. He was speaking at a news conference in Washington alongside the Attorney General and the head of Homeland Security, John Kelly, who said the order was necessary.
Unregulated, unvetted travel is not a universal privilege, especially when national security is at stake. The White House worked closely with the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the Department of State to create an order that addresses previous concerns and protects the homeland and every one of our citizens. We do not make the law, but are sworn to enforce it. We have no other option.
Several U.S. states which took legal action to block the original travel ban imposed by President Trump in January say they are still considering their response. The Attorney General for Washington State said the new version represented a significant victory. The Democratic Party's leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, said it made Americans less safe, not more, and should be repealed. Lee Gelland of the American Civil Liberties Union said the new directive wasn't good enough.
The new executive order eliminates certain individuals, lawful permanent residents, Iraqis who were part of the first order, but it does not eliminate the central constitutional problem. In our view, the first order was based on religious discrimination, and this order is as well, so we will continue to challenge it.
Leaders of the French centre-right have reasserted their support for their presidential candidate, François Fillon, in next month's election. The French Senate leader, Gérard Larcher, said all attempts to replace him as the candidate must end. Mr. Fillon, once the front-runner, has lost support after being told he was being investigated for alleged embezzlement. He denies the charges and has refused to step aside, saying there was no plan B. The Peruvian government has recalled its ambassador to Venezuela amid a deepening diplomatic row. The authorities in Lima have sent a formal letter of protest after Venezuela's foreign minister called Peru's president a coward and a dog obedient to the United States. Peru said it would not tolerate insults. Nicholas Rocha from our Americas desk has the details.
In a recent trip to the U.S., the Peruvian president Pedro Pablo Kuczynski compared Latin America to a well-behaved dog, but said Venezuela was a big problem. The remark annoyed the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, who called for an apology over the weekend. On Monday, his foreign minister said Mr. Kuczynski was the only dog, always wagging its tail to the empire. The Peruvian foreign minister, Ricardo Luna, said President Kuczynski was using a metaphor. Since center-right governments came to power in Brazil and Argentina in recent months, President Maduro has been increasingly isolated in Latin America.
World News from the BBC. The leaders of 4 key member states of the European Union have outlined their visions for the future of the institution less than 3 weeks before they're due to gather in Italy to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding Treaty of Rome. President Hollande of France, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and the Italian and Spanish prime ministers all spoke of a future in which there would be both more integration but also more opportunities for countries to approach European cooperation at different speeds. North Korea has described the launch of 4 missiles on Monday as a training exercise for a strike on US military bases in Japan. The official news agency in Pyongyang said the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, personally supervised the firing. There's been international condemnation of the missile launches. The US and Japan have requested an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Five police officers have been killed in Niger in an attack blamed on Islamist extremists. Officials say it happened close to the western border with Mali. On Saturday, the government of Niger declared a state of emergency in seven border areas in response to attacks carried out by militants based in Mali. Scientists in Australia say they've found that many common trees there can't store as much carbon as previously thought. Researchers at Western Sydney University say their study casts doubt on the extent to which trees can offset carbon emissions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian team says its research indicates that international estimates of carbon storage in forests could be too high. For the last 5 years, eucalyptus trees on the edge of Sydney have been subjected to elevated concentrations of carbon dioxide through a series of 28-metre-high pipes. The experiment is said to mimic the sort of CO2 levels we could see by 2050. Results have shown that poor soil quality has prevented the native trees from absorbing more of the gas.
BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Roger Hearing. Coming up on the programme today, President Trump has a second go at an executive order putting in place a travel ban. So is it legally watertight this time? Also, the centre-right in France hang on to François Fillon as their presidential candidate, despite falling poll ratings and a legal investigation into his financial arrangements. And keeping up with the children's party scene in Singapore.
I think it's a bit of a peer pressure, and if one person starts to throw an incredible party, it's a little bit of an indication for other parents.
And I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific, Anjani Trivedi, columnist for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street column, who's joining us from Singapore, and Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts and founder of Democracy at Work, who's joining us from New York. So, Richard, I'll say good evening to you.
Good evening to you as well.
And you're very welcome to the programme. And right across the other side of the world, Anjani, I'll say good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you're also very welcome. Now, the new presidential executive order signed by President Trump bans travel to the United States from six mainly Muslim countries for 90 days. It is a revised version. The first one got mired in the US court system as judges challenged it on grounds of injustice and discrimination against Muslims. The new one takes Iraq off the list of banned countries, drops an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees, and removes a preference for admitting Christian refugees. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, said it was an important document.
This executive order seeks to protect the American people as well as lawful immigrants by putting in place an enhanced screening and vetting process for visitors from six countries. Three of these nations are state sponsors of terrorism. The other three have served as safe havens for terrorist countries, countries where governments have lost control of their territory to terrorist groups like ISIL or Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
And this executive order, though controversial, does have its supporters. David Rivkin is a lawyer who served under Presidents Reagan and George Bush Sr.
Even the first order should have survived. It really, to me, was an outrageous example of judicial imperialism and violation of separation of powers. But this order is better explicated, frankly, than any other country-specific order that had been issued by the previous six presidents. It explains, for example, very nicely, even though you don't have to explain, why Iraq, while a country with serious problems like the other six, is nevertheless put in a different category. To me, this, first of all, I would give you 100% odds that this order would, in the end of the day, survive. If it is taken down by any district court, that would be, to me, a shameful moment for the judiciary, because there's absolutely no basis to stop it, even temporarily.
David Rivkin. But has it been revised enough to avoid problems in the courts? Ambassador Norman Eisen was senior counsel to President Obama. He's now at the Brookings Institution. So is it legally watertight?
The United States courts are about to determine whether it is or it is not. It's better than the first one. If this order had been floated out first, it might have survived. But there are still very profound questions, above all, about whether this is simply a prettied-up Muslim ban, as we say here in the States, lipstick on a pig. So I think the courts are going to have a very hard look at that issue.
Well, take me through the things that are better about it, in legal terms at least.
Well, unlike the initial order, there's been a paring back of the number of states. So Iraq is now not included in the order, and there's some sound basis for that. There's a better effort to articulate a national security basis for the order. But the biggest thing that represents an improvement over the initial order, I'm not saying it's good enough to make it constitutional necessarily, but the biggest improvement is that green card holders and others who have legally cognizable relationships with the United States, although they're not yet citizens, are not included in this order. That was a great weakness of the first order, and it's clever what they've done here, which is to try to confine the order to those who have the weakest constitutional protections, those who are outside the country and who don't have definite legal standing to enter.
Do you think the removal of Iraq from the list of states, was that in a way an attempt to make it more legally acceptable, do you think, or politically acceptable?
Well, I think there's a political aspect to it and a legal aspect to it. Obviously, it does create political complications for us, given the United States' complicated relationship with Iraq and the fact that people like interpreters who had worked with the U.S. Army were being barred by this previous order, putting their lives in jeopardy. So that's the political aspect. The legal aspect is that you have an order with seven countries that was knocked down by the courts, so you want to try to find ways to vary it. So it probably is legally helpful as well. You can say to the court, no, it's a different order entirely, Your Honor.
Okay, well, what are the main remaining weaknesses, would you think, if this were now being challenged, as some of the attorneys general around the country have suggested they might?
The largest weakness is the evidence that, as President Trump said again and again during the campaign, he wants to ban Muslims from coming into the country. So his intent still remains there. You have his advisors who have said, for example, Stephen Miller, that it's basically the same order. And then you have leaks of intelligence out of the Department of Homeland Security in the United States saying that this is not the right way to go about it at all. If one wants to minimize terror incidents, the right thing to do is focus on individuals, not on countries. So there's some evidence that's to the contrary of the order from Mr. Trump's own executive branch. Those are all weaknesses that might very well lead a judge to say, we found this unconstitutional once as a Muslim ban. You've done the same thing over again, and it doesn't really pass muster.
So if I can draw your summary together, as it were, in legal terms, you think it's better, probably legally, but it may not be good enough.
It's certainly stronger. They've read the opinions around the country, which predominantly criticized the previous order. They've removed some of the most onerous provisions, but they may or may not have gone far enough. It'll be up to the courts to judge.
Ambassador Norman Eisen there. Richard, do you think there's a danger perhaps of fixating on this, which is obviously quite important, but in a way ignoring a vast amount of other stuff that's going on in Washington at the moment?
Yes, and I think that's the major point here. Clearly the first order was a rush to make political hay by appearing to be the savior who keeps the dangerous people out. The truth of the matter is, the minute you look at it, the dangerous people, however you define them, are not at all kept out. I mean, after all, the country from which the people came who did the greatest damage, far exceeding everything else, the 9/11 catastrophe, they almost all came from Saudi Arabia, which is a missing element in all of this story. If you really wanted to follow the history here, what in the world are you doing? And the answer is, you're leaving Saudi Arabia out because we need Saudi Arabia for oil politics and all the rest. And what that does is make you begin to realize realize that the rush into an unsustainably illegal activity first time around is only surviving to this newer form in order to save face, to keep this charade going that it's a serious issue for the United States at this point, faced with a crisis economy, faced with a level of political disaffection we've not seen for half a century, to be worried about which exact country under which exact circumstances will for 90 days not be a... It's childish. It's a classic political deflection from the issues that are real onto something that you hope people will pay attention to because they're fearful about conditions in general. And here's at least something that they can maybe be convinced has to do with their safety.
Well, clearly it is something very important to Donald Trump's team. Anjani, let me come to you on this. I mean, seeing it from the distance that you are seeing it, I suppose, I mean, is it something that's making the headlines in Singapore and in Asia?
It is, but I'd say, you know, the reality is you have to question the basis of this. And I think Richard alluded to this, as did Ambassador Eisen. The reality is it's a ban. It's religious discrimination. And I think no matter where you look in the world, people may have different views, but you don't see this kind of blatant discrimination.
Well, clearly they would say, they'd say it isn't because they're not actually specifying Muslims. They're simply talking about particular countries.
And here... Right. And here, they aren't necessarily saying that, but they are, in a way, it's more broad-based. So while they said, for example, and I think this kind of went under the, this kind of got covered by the travel ban news, is that they said that, you know, they were going to suspend a fast-track processing program for skilled workers, the H-1B program. Now, why, and this was announced at the same time, for example, and so you are discriminating against people from across the world, and so it's causing a lot of issues in India because there's a lot of tech companies from there that send people, and you know, the reality is the earlier order, you know, under the earlier order, 60,000 visas were revoked, and the latest fact sheet from the White House says that, you know, visas are not going to be solely rejected on the basis of this order. So then what's the point of this order?
We'll see how it all works out, because I mean, I think a lot is going to come out in the detail, as indeed, of course, did with the first one. But that will remain. We may see more scenes at protest at airports. Let's see. Anyway, in the meantime, let's bring ourselves right up to date with the latest headlines with Jonathan Izard.
Senior members of the Trump administration have defended the new executive order signed by the president imposing a 90-day ban on travelers from six mainly Muslim countries. Iraq has been taken off the original list after agreement on additional vetting measures. An emergency meeting of the main centre-right party in France has backed François Fillon as its presidential candidate despite allegations of embezzlement against him. Mr. Fillon denies the charges. The Peruvian government has recalled its ambassador to Venezuela amid a deepening diplomatic row. Venezuela's foreign minister called Peru's president a coward and a dog obedient to the United States. And scientists in Australia say they found that many common trees can't store as much carbon as previously thought, casting doubt on the extent to which trees can offset carbon emissions.
Thanks, Jonathan. Let's pick up on one of those stories. François Fillon has had, a pretty rough few weeks. Accusations that he employed his wife to do a non-existent job have led to a legal investigation of the man who is the Conservative candidate for the French presidency, and his ratings have fallen drastically as pressure has grown for him to drop out. However, late on Monday, the leaders of his centre-right party confirmed him as their candidate in the April vote. The French Senate leader, Gérard Larcher, said the leadership had unanimously backed Monsieur Fillon.
The political committee has, after a long debate, unanimously renewed its support for François Fillon and is committed to working to gather the political family of the right and the centre around him and around the political project that he carries out for the national recovery. François Fillon declared that he will take initiatives to uphold our values together. So the Republicans are gathered around and strongly support François Fillon. Thank you.
Well, in what's being seen as an election that could determine the future of Europe, the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen is polling strongly, and the independent centrist Emmanuel Macron is seen as her main challenger, with Mr. Fillon trailing badly because of the scandal. Bruno Bernard is a political advisor to Monsieur Fillon's Les Républicains party, and he was shocked that Monsieur Fillon wasn't forced to step down by the party.
Any other candidate could have done slightly better, and slightly better is quite good. I mean, you have to remember that there is no campaign going on. The only thing that France is talking about is the Penelope Gate, the Fillon Gate, and all the problems that the Républicains are facing. So without any campaign, it's difficult to win an election.
So I asked Hugh Schofield in Paris if Monsieur Fillon's party really thinks they do stand a chance of winning with him as their candidate.
Well, I mean, of course they're going to say they think they can, but privately, I know that they're in deep dudgeon. I mean, they really are extremely concerned and angry that an election which was really theirs for the taking, and remember, François Fillon was regarded as an absolute shoo-in for the next president, should be now almost unwinnable. I mean, they've gone down so hard in the polls in the last few weeks that they've been overtaken by Emmanuel Macron, the centrists, which means that most likely it'll be a Emmanuel Macron Marine Le Pen runoff, and that means, you know, the mainstream party of the right won't be in the second round. And it also means, by the way, that the mainstream party of the left, the socialists, won't be in the second round either. It really is an unparalleled election, historically speaking. But, you know, from the Republicans' point of view, the whole thing is an absolute disaster. And they may be pleased now that they've got some kind of closure, to use the ghastly phrase, on this episode. But, it's not a particularly happy closure.
Well, I was going to say, why then stick with Fillon? Why not Juppé? Why not Sarkozy?
Well, I mean, there's one very simple reason for that, which is that juridically, legally, it's impossible to get rid of Fillon if he's minded to stay, and he has been minded to stay. The primaries were in a legal framework with rules that were set out and approved by the body in France that oversees elections and so on, and it's not something they can get out of. Their only hope was to persuade him, by gentlemanly arts, to give way, but on the grounds that he was a liability. But he says he's not a liability. He says, well, the alternatives were just as much a liability, and he may not have been wrong there. I mean, he was always saying, look, I'm standing for something very, very clear. If you lose me, you'll get Alain Juppé. And ultimately, what happened today when Alain Juppé said he wasn't going to run was Alain Juppé's admission that he didn't have the guts or the energy to do it. And that was victory for François Fillon. Talk of maybe another candidate petered out fairly fast. And Fillon now is the only one left.
So is it really a matter of going through the motions for the party? Because they all know pretty much that it's going to be a stop Le Pen effort in the end.
No, I mean, I think they can legitimately have a go. I mean, I said earlier on that the poll ratings went down. They did go down, but, I mean, Fillon's still at 17, 18%. If he starts getting up to the 20, 21%, if something happens in the Macron campaign, who knows what, you know, for at last people start talking critically about his programme, maybe he says something stupid, he goes down a bit. It's not unplayable. I mean, they must be hoping for a miracle like that, or indeed like something being pulled out of the hat in the judicial front, maybe the court or the investigating magistrate saying, well, actually, on second thoughts, I don't think there is enough in this case to place him under judicial investigation. At that point, Fillon can say, look, you know, I am justified. I was right to keep going. Can you imagine what would have happened if I had not been allowed to run because of these judges? And in the end, I was innocent. And that would be a very, very strong argument in his favour. Admittedly, it's a bit of a long shot, but there is a strong argument that he makes, Fillon, which is that the judicial proceedings against him were timed to bring him down. I mean, I think people can see that. It's almost certainly true.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Well, from that sort of party to a very different, rather more enjoyable party. A recent report suggests parents in some rich countries spend thousands of dollars on birthday parties for their children. Seems for some no expense should be spared ensuring their little darlings are treated like a prince or princess for the day. So, for companies, there's big money to be made out of spoiled children. In Singapore, many of the city-states well-heeled even employ party planners, as if they're arranging a wedding rather than a birthday. The BBC's Sharanjit Lail has been along to one such party.
A man playing with futuristic laser lights, stormtroopers dancing on stage while Darth Vader does cartwheels. It all sounds like a big Broadway show, but it's not. It's a children's party in Singapore, which cost $150,000.
Hello and welcome to this fan fairy casting celebration.
Staging such parties has become big business for party planners like Tanya Quinn. For nearly a decade, she's put together such soirees. She sorts everything out, from the cake to the venue. She's even known to dress as a fairy to double up as an entertainer.
Most of them do have an idea of how much they're going to spend. We don't mention money to the kids because the kids are just kids and they don't understand that concept. But then if the kids are really like, oh, but I really want to have it, mommy, you know, then the parent might go, okay, we'll have it.
On average, parents coming to her have budgets of just over $2,000 for children as young as one. But you don't always need a party planner. For parents like John and Dr. Elaine Kim, a party for their 100-day-old baby, Nate, is more than just a fun celebration. It's part of tradition.
Happy birthday to you.
Historically, it's kind of like the Chinese one-month party. It's a celebration to say, we're out of the woods here, the baby made it past 100 days. These days, I think it's a little bit more like, wow, the parents are still alive after 100 days.
They've invited 100 of their friends to an ice cream-themed party and are giving it the personal touch. But in line with the trend towards even bigger budgets, it's being held at one of Singapore's most luxurious hotels, where celebrities like Madonna have stayed. High-end event planner Olga Isselis offers some advice.
Well, I think it's a bit of a peer pressure. And if one person starts to throw an incredible party, it's a little bit of an indication for other parents to do a similar thing.
So as parents strive to create memories of special days, it could also mean a lot of money going up in a puff of smoke, long after the candles are blown out.
There we are. Fun in Singapore. Anjani, do you get invited to these things?
I have been invited to a couple. and as a parent, it makes you wonder whether you're just pandering to your child too much.
Yeah, you wouldn't spend that much, would you? On a child's birthday party? No, surely not.
No, I think I don't want to set myself up for failure for future years.
Is the pressure though? Do you find? I mean, is it keeping up?
Of course. There is definitely pressure, and I think part of it is, people start going the other way. Some people start saying, you know what, we're just going to do a birthday party in a park this year, and then. Everyone else starts feeling conscious and says, oh, well, actually, you know what? We will keep it low key. We'll just get a nice cake. And maybe that is the way to do it. Mm. So it goes both ways, I'd say. Parties, it's
yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's important, isn't it? I mean, I remember the big thing was party bags, actually. And my children were that age. You had to have a bigger, better party bag than anyone else. So, Richard, you're well away from all this, I'm assuming. Yes?
No.
No?
Not at all. No. Here in the United States, where there's a phobia about all kinds of things, there is a notion that you aren't an important person if you don't show it. It's a sad story. Let me give you an example. One of the leading economic advisors to Mr. Trump is Stephen Schwarzman. He's a multi-billionaire, head of the Blackstone fund, a hedge fund, and a private equity group. 10 years ago, when he had a 60th birthday party, he did it in the New York City Armory, a vast space mainly for the military that was dressed up with elephants and enormous amount of money. 10 years later, because we've had a crash of our economic system, he hid it in his big ranch house in Palm Beach, Florida. But it got a lot of coverage. Estimates are $7 to $10 million were spent for an evening on the beach in Florida to let everybody know through the New York Times and a dozen other publications what it meant to have camels, multiple camels, trapeze artists, endless food and drink. And it's a kind of extraordinary demonstration that the recovery may not have made it to mass of Americans, but there's always a few who can tell you what the other half lives like.
And that's the way they want it to be, I guess.
Yes, conspicuous
consumption in the most obvious way. Well, there we are. Parties in, Florida and Singapore. Stay with us. Much more coming up here in the Party of Business Matters. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Roger Hearing, and my guests today, Anjani Trivedi and Richard Wolff. Now, Anjani, your first time on the programme. I hope it's gone all right so far. And in traditional style, we just sort of introduce you, really, to our audience. So a little bit of your how you got to where you are and where you come from and all the rest of it. I mean, briefly, you've had quite a mixed career because you weren't always a journalist, were you?
No. So I started off after university. I started off in investment banking in New York and in London. And then I moved to India and I was doing private equity there. I then was moving to Hong Kong and decided that I had to do more with my life. And so I did a master's in journalism and got into journalism.
So that's very interesting. So I just pick up on that. You said do more with your life.
Sure.
So it's interesting. I've not heard journalism described entirely in that way before, but
I think you just feel, you know, you're not doing enough when you're just, you know, you're young, you're in finance, you're kind of sitting here looking around yourself and the world is falling apart in the depths of the crisis. And you're wondering why you're sitting here still.
Well, perhaps it was the bankers that caused it. Who knows? That's what you could say.
Well, but also just sitting around pitching, you know, and then everyone's trying to justify their job. So you're sitting there, you know, making pitch books for companies, you know, for toilet companies in Europe or shipping company mergers that are taking 2 years or 3 years. And so
was there a light bulb
moment?
Was there a kind of a bit where you thought?
I think it was, you know, I think it was more impatience. I think when you're young, you think, well, did I work this hard to just, is this what my life is going to be like? Is this what I'm going to do? And so it was this constant attempt to try to do more. And so when I did move to India, it was partly because it was going to be a mix of finance and development. So, you know, you'd be funding companies that are providing water to thousands of people. And
you worked
like
with
that.
An MP and, there as well, didn't you, for a little bit?
Yeah, I did. I did work with an MP there. And that was partly the switch was also when I moved from this private equity organization into this, which was more of a grassroots organization, trying to get exposure to that. And I loved that job.
What did you do in the job exactly?
So we were dealing with a lot of the MP's constituents, and part of it was also creating sustainable social enterprises for the people in his constituency. So working with a lot of the women there to set up self-help groups and various ways that they could monetize the skills that they had. So that was really interesting work because it's helping them understand that there are things they can do and to feel more empowered, kind of subtly breaking past cultural norms in a way.
It's pretty tough trying to do that as well, though, isn't it? I mean, it's not easy.
Yeah, and it is. And it was at times frustrating, at times, at times it was very rewarding. I'd say when you'd see somebody turn or somebody see their daughter do something and it meant the world, and it was a father who was suddenly so proud of a daughter he only thought he could marry off. And it sounds so traditional, but that was really it.
And you got a great deal of satisfaction from that.
Yeah, and I did really enjoy that. And then I was moving to Hong Kong, and actually while I was doing that, I was doing a lot of the media work for this MP, and, you know, just kind of on the side. It hadn't really been a part of my job description, if you will, and so
because he had quite a rough time. I think it was Naveen Jindal, wasn't he? Colgate. I seem to remember someone too.
Yes.
What was all that about?
I know people are. There are many critics out there, but that was his business side, and we never dealt with that. But it would take, you know, on top of what the government allocates members of parliament, he would take a significant part of his own earnings and put them into his constituency as his extra kind of, he would say, here's a sum of money and we need to put this into the constituency. And so the amount he did for the people in his constituency with his own money, it just shows that there is, regardless of his business dealings, I'd say, you know, we have to kind of look, you know, you have to look at what he had done in that constituency. And yes, there is obviously questions of where that money potentially came from and things like that. And I'm not condoning it by any means, but I do think there you have to look at the charitable aspect of what, or you know, the charitable aspect behind what he was trying to do for all these people in an area that he'd grown up in, and you know, generations of his family have worked for.
So, Anthony, how easy was it to go into journalism, just generally? I mean, you were quite established as a very successful person involved in the world of finance, but was it just a, oh, right, I'll do something else, and you moved into it, or was there more to it than that?
I think it was a more, there was a lot more deliberation. I decided that I should do a master's to gain legitimacy. I didn't think I came with enough to just, you know, suddenly segue into journalism and suddenly start freelancing or suddenly start writing. I wanted to, you know, that's kind of the person I am. I wanted to take the appropriate paths to, you know, make sure that I was qualified and I had some backing. And so the program here at the Hong Kong University prepared me for that. It was a one-year program, and I did the master's. And I ended up at the Wall Street Journal.
Ah, well, that's where you've ended up. You didn't just walk straight into that, though, I'm assuming.
No, I didn't. And, you know, I did a few internships along the way. I was at the New York Times in India for an internship. I was at CNN in Hong Kong and at Time Magazine in Hong Kong.
You've moved around. You've lived in a lot of interesting different places, haven't you? I mean, Richard, let me bring you in on this, because, I mean, you know, you're, I guess, a consumer of journalism as well as a contributor to it in many ways. But do you think that sort of background of, you know, India, Hong Kong, MIT, all kinds of places, is that important to give people perspective when they're trying to report in the way the Wall Street Journal is?
Yes, I think it can be very helpful. It gives a background. It gives some depth. It leads a person to ask interesting and penetrating questions about what they see. The problem with it is it can embroil the student, if they're not very sophisticated, in a level of received wisdom about things that then becomes a lens with which they can't function other than that, and so they see everything as a reflection of what they were taught.
So it's kind of a template, really, for the world.
Right. So what you want to do is get out of the academic the big questions to ask, and then have the courage not to be limited when what you look at is the real world, to see whether even some of those questions you were taught to ask are not the questions that need to be asked.
That's an interesting jump, isn't it? I mean, Richard, I guess you come from the world of academe, of course.
Right.
But do you find that it odd, the difference between the kind of questions a journalist will ask about something and the kind of questions an academic will ask about something? Both, in a way, seeking the truth, of course.
Yes, but I wish there were more of a difference. What I tend to see, to be honest, is particularly in economics reporting, a tendency to rewrite the script of the basic economics that you were taught, fearful of going beyond it, fearful of being critical of it. It has to do a little bit with the education that is so monochromatic in economics, very rarely teaching students alternative theories, alternative ways of understanding things. So it's a bit unfair to ask the student to go beyond the teacher. But if the student doesn't, then what the journalism becomes is a rehash of what's going on in the university, and that does no one any good.
Well, Anthony, that's interesting. You're an MIT mathematician, of course. And I mean, does that ring bells for you, what Richard's saying?
No, I think, Richard, I completely agree. And I do think even if, you know, even outside in our profession, even if, so I did study economics as well, and you know, one of the things is the world has changed so much, and so your notion of basic economic theories don't always apply in the same way that you were taught about. And so I do think it's very important to reconsider that. And even if you're out of school, I'm not saying go back to school and go get re-educated, but I think in the process of reporting, it's very important to, we have access to all sorts of academics in several in universities across the world. We have access to the internet and, you know, academic papers. And I always, and sometimes, you know, it's funny because my editor sometimes says this. He's like, you collect so much information, because I do think you have to take a 360-degree view before, you know, a 360-degree understanding, rather, before you take a view.
But that's the point. And when you take a view, you're making it in a way simple in order to get it to the people who you want to understand the situation. But
sure. But I feel like you have to. It has to be an educated view, and I think, you know, the role of, for example, now the role I'm currently in, it's a column. It's a financial analysis and investment column, and a lot of it is not about, it's not necessarily what exactly is just going on. It's about, it's saying that this is going on, and we connect the dots to say this is what this could mean, this is what this means, or this is our view on this. And that has, you know, plenty of reporting has gone behind those 400 words and talking to investors, talking to academics, doing, you know, crunching the numbers. And we present it in that 400 words. And so I do think that it is the reporter's job to go beyond what they just beyond what they know and question themselves and question, rather than fall into the frame of this is how it should work. This is what I was taught in economics, and this is the demand and supply theory, and that's just it.
Yeah, but the problem, Richard, I know that you find this, is that it is difficult because as journalists, one has to simplify things. You have to take a line. You can't. An academic will always say, well, it's very complicated. A journalist has to say, well, actually, it's quite simple. And there is that huge difference, which must be frustrating for the academics as well half the time.
It is, but, you know, the students are capable of understanding that there's more than one way to pose a question in economics, more than one theory that can offer an answer. You know, when we teach a course, for example, in religion, we would never teach only one kind of religion and pass it off as religion in general. We would teach students there's Christian religion and Muslim religion and so forth. There are different ways of posing the most fundamental questions about life one can imagine. The same is true in economics, and yet you will find very few economics departments that hire the people or develop the curriculum that would really give students the ability to pose and answer questions in a multiplicity of different approaches, even though I'm convinced, and my teaching experience proves it, that students are not only willing, but are much more interested in the subject when they can begin to feel that there's conflict and disagreement
and
in
complexity.
The theory.
And complexity.
That's right. As there is in life.
Yeah, but
it's not so simple, you know, as supply and demand or all the little
agreed.
Stories we tell in economics. Those are simplifications that need to be unpacked if you're going to do creative work in journalism.
Agreed.
All right,
but you'd be surprised. You know, and I agree with that. And I do think that, you know, you'd be surprised, though, some of the best journalists come up with, you know, they'll take the economics of it and translate it into a story or into a, you know, into an anecdote that, you know, that the best of us will relate to. And so I do think that's part of journalism, right, is telling that tale and explaining it to people. And, you know, you could go talk about, you know, equations and numbers, but I think the you know, here it's taking different aspects of people's lives and connecting them and telling them this is how this is at play. And for example, you know, China, we wrote a 2,000-word story in October this past year, and it was about how China's increasingly behavior of increasing onshoring or making more at home has affected global imports and global trade. And, you know, on the face of it, that seems like a pretty, you know, to people who aren't trade experts and perhaps, you know, growth economists, that for them, perhaps it's like, so what? But I think, you know, we related it through a frying pan and a company that was making chemicals that go on top of the nonstick frying pans that was based in China, and how that affects the global supply chain. And, you know, you look at the frying pan that you use every morning to make your eggs, and that's hanging in millions of kitchens in the United States or across the world. And that's part of the global supply chain. I think that's where that creativity comes in, and based on, of course, the underlying, you know, data and trends and numbers and, you know, the education.
But you can bring it all back down to a frying pan, which is, I suppose, the simple explanation of a complicated process. Perhaps that's what we're all about.
Anyway. And that's what people want to read.
And that's what we'll have to leave for the moment. Thank you to pay the view on that. Let's bring ourselves right up to date with the Business Matters headlines with Jonathan Izard.
President Donald Trump has signed a new executive order placing a 90-day ban on people from six mainly Muslim nations. Iraq, which was covered in the previous seven-nation order, has been removed from the new one after agreeing to additional visa vetting measures. In Tokyo, the Nikkei 225 is currently trading 9 points up at 19,370. And shares in Snap, the owner of Snapchat, slid 12% on Monday to close below the price at which they started trading just last week in New York. The stock soared on Thursday after making its Wall Street debut.
Jonathan, thanks. Now, it's that moment where we link up with one of our reporters, and today it's Rahul Tandon joining us on the line from Kolkata. Rahul, cybercrime making the news in the area you are at the moment.
Yeah, very much so, Roger. Looking forward to something being thrown in my frying pan in the next 10 or 15 minutes' time. But yes, cybercrime, this really follows an investigation by the BBC into TalkTalk, one of the big mobile phone companies based in the UK, where they found that there was almost an industrial level of fraud being perpetrated from India. Basically, it works very simply that they phone up people, they get databases, many of them of elderly people in the UK phone up, say there's a problem with your computer, we can fix it for you. People not really understanding technology say very good, and then give them their bank details, and before they know it, a lot of money has been withdrawn from their bank accounts. It's something I've looked into as well, and I've spoken to the head of the cybercrime unit here, who says, look, the problem is that a lot of people who come to work in what they think are call centers are actually being lured into another form of crime instead, often unwillingly, and that it's very difficult to track these people down. You find their IP address, they move to another one. You find where they're working from, they move to another one there. So certainly cybercrime from India, a big problem, particularly there seems to be a problem here in Kolkata. But now even Indians may be perpetrating it on people in other parts of the world, but they're suffering from it here as well. A lot of Nigerian fraud taking place in India. I suppose it's part of the modern world we live in. You've just got to be very careful when somebody calls you.
Indeed, a lesson well learned. Now let's bring us up to date on a story I think that's emerged in the last few hours. A bad story, an Indian air ambulance crashing near Bangkok. What was that all about?
Yeah, this is from the Medanta Hospital. I mean, India does a lot of medical tourism. So here we had a situation where doctors from Delhi were on their way to Bangkok to perform burn surgery there. India really becoming a powerhouse when it comes to medical knowledge in this region. But unfortunately, this air ambulance crashed near Bangkok. One person dead so far, two of the doctors are injured, but we think that they might survive there. So really a very unfortunate incident that has taken place, and very rare for India, and I'm sure that there will be some concern about the impacts that it could have on medical tourism here.
And indeed making the headlines, I'm sure, they're in India, and obviously we'll bring you up to date on the day details when we get them on that. Now finally, Rahul, people might be a bit late for work where you are today, because they're going to be watching cricket perhaps.
Yes, India-Australia, fourth day of the test match, beautifully poised, India fighting back yesterday. I have to say, 9 o'clock onwards, my phone's going to be switched off. Going to be some sort of technical problem that suddenly happens. So it starts around 9 o'clock. I think a lot of people will be a little bit late to work. And if they are at work today, I'd check what they're watching on their computer screens. It may not be those invoices that they should be dealing with. You might find that they're streaming cricket instead.
And your prediction for the outcome?
Oh, it's easy India victory. Don't know what the Aussies are even bothering to turn up for today. Might as well give it up.
There we are. See, unbiased, totally balanced news there from the BBC. Rahul, thanks very much indeed. Rahul Tandon there, live on the line from Kolkata. Now, we don't know what Rahul was wearing there, perhaps cricket-watching clothes, whatever that might be. But one of the advantages of working in radio, of course, is we've no idea what he was wearing. Dress codes are, frankly, not rigid. I can wear what I like. I invite you to guess what I am wearing. Ties are certainly not required, not for many years. In some jobs, of course, that's a very different situation. Parts of the corporate world have some very strict dress rules indeed. Well, our well-dressed regular commentator, Lucy Kellaway of the Financial Times, has been musing on this.
What people wear to work at investment banks, management consultancies and top law firms is ridiculous. This hit me recently when watching Tony Erdmann, a German comedy film in which a youngish management consultant is visited at work by her father, who turns up uninvited wearing a shaggy brown wig, a shiny suit and a set of joke shop teeth. As his vast, unkempt figure lumbered through the gleaming office, it occurred to me that the absurd one was not him, barely able to speak through his mouthful of snaggly gnashers. It was the consultants, all shiny and beautiful and looking exactly the same as one another. In the past decade, what people in the best-paid jobs look like has got more uniform and more extreme. There is an unwritten dress code that everyone has to follow and which goes like this. There is no such thing as too expensive. There's no such thing as too toned. There's no such thing as too bland. No one dares look individual. The only way of standing out is by looking even sleeker and richer than everyone else. These rules apply equally to men and women. Only women must look as sexy as possible without looking tasteless. Sheryl Sandberg has nailed it. Kim Kardashian has not. Not long ago, I gave a talk to a top US law firm at 11 in the morning. There were 8 women lawyers in the room, 5 of whom were slavishly doing a Sandberg in tight, unforgiving dresses in block colours and crippling, towering heels. I'm not sure at what point work became like this, a rigid cocktail party minus the cocktails, but it's vaguely troubling. We rightly make a fuss when receptionists wear heels because their employers demand it, but not about the women who feel obliged to dress this way because their colleagues do. These industries employ ambitious, competitive people, and it's no surprise if dress becomes as competitive as everything else. The buildings they work in make it worse. Banking and consulting offices are competing with each other to be the shiniest, the smartest, the most blandly ostentatious, encouraging the people in them to do likewise. Last week, I turned up to a meeting in an investment bank in flat boots and a navy blue corduroy shirt dress that cost about $40. It was more or less the right size, newish and cleanish. The only flesh on display was hands, neck and face. It was practical, demure and comfortable. As I looked around at the other people, men in fabulously tailored suits and women in shapely jackets and discreet gold earrings, I felt as outlandish as Tony Erdmann. I was a weirdo, a pauper, distinctly inferior. I'm not sure who benefits from the extravagant, super sleek, super bland dress code. Possibly clients are more likely to trust advisors who dress professionally, but only up to a point. Customers can't enjoy being systematically outdressed. Unless the point is that by subtly humiliating their clients, those bankers, lawyers and consultants find it easier to lord it over them, making them less likely to protest at being charged the fees that make such extravagant wardrobes possible. This is Lucy Kellaway for the BBC World Service.
Well, there we are. And I, of course, am wearing a formal suit at the moment with a small bow tie, just putting that in there because it's radio. Now, Anjani, full disclosure, what are you wearing?
I am wearing black jeans, a white shirt and a grey sweater and flats.
And we believe
because
you.
I knew I was going to be on radio. That would be very different if I was going to be on TV.
Yep. Okay. And Richard, what are you wearing then?
Same as all your implications here. I'm very relaxed. I'm wearing a shirt and jeans, enjoying the fact that by not being on television, I don't have to be caught up in the rigmarole that was so aptly described a few moments ago, and that serves no reasonable purpose that I can discern.
Well, that's the interesting, the reasonable purpose of it. I mean, in the world of academics, Richard, I mean, is there some kind of dress code generally? I mean, would you be wearing the same thing if you were standing in front of a room full of students?
Probably. There is now, it's called a certain kind of shabby chic. You don't have to be neatly pressed. You don't even have to be all that clean. You can't go too far in the other direction. But other than that, there's the same sort of dress code. It's just a different set of items in your ensemble than what you would need in a lawyer's office or a banker's office. The conformity of it all is the tragedy, and that's there in the academic world just as much as everywhere else.
Yeah, because I suppose you're saying, look, my mind is on so many higher things, I couldn't possibly be so vain or you know, shallow that I wouldn't really bother about what I wear. Is that fair?
Well, it's the claim that some would make, but it's belied by the reality of how concerned they are to fit in. I remember one of my colleagues explaining why he had just arranged for leather patches to be put on the elbows of his jacket. I said, oh, was there a risk that you would wear them out? Were they worn out? Oh, no, he turned to me. I never would wear them out, but they have to be there. Otherwise, I would look weird in the situation. Well, that's the same mentality that you see everywhere else. It's just the outfit is different. The mentality, unfortunately, not so much.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's the weirdness thing. I mean, Anjani, I guess in the circles you move, you have to look as if you fit in those circles, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of both, right? I think personally, you want to feel well-heeled and well-dressed. And I think that's, you know, and you want to get up in the morning, you want to get dressed and leave the house. If I'm going to get up and leave the house and, you know, something that makes me feel very casual, then that's fine. There's some days I know I'm very busy and all I have to do is write. I will wear the most comfortable pair of pants and the warmest sweater and sit at my desk and type away because I know I'm not leaving the office that day. There's days I know I have to be out and about in meetings. And yeah, I do want to feel well-dressed, not because I'm trying to, personally, not because I'm trying to conform to who I'm going to meet, but just because I feel like, you know, I should be more presentable and I feel more presentable that way.
But you say not as to who you meet, but I mean, if you're going to interview a CEO, a major company, I mean, wouldn't you dress to impress? Isn't that part of it?
Well, I don't need to impress the CEO. I think, why would I need to impress him? I just need to ask him questions and get my story and try to understand what his business is doing. And if he's as shallow as to sit there and judge me because I'm not going to show up in ripped jeans, but if I were to wear a corduroy dress like Lucy did and flat boots, then yeah, if that's what I wanted to do, then that's fine. I wouldn't do that. That's a separate issue. But I don't think I personally don't do that as a means to impress another person.
Right. Well, we'll take that on board when we get interviewed by you. I can only say that on the one occasion I had a terrible dirty shirt and I was stuck in the middle of a war zone. There wasn't anyone actually firing at me.
Though.
I just put on a flak jacket and people didn't notice what I was wearing. They went, oh my gosh, he's wearing a flak jacket. Anyway, that's a story from long ago. Many thanks to both of you. Many thanks to all of you for listening. That's Business Matters from a well-dressed team. Bye-bye.
For more from the world of finance, try Business Daily, one of our most popular podcasts. Go to bbcworldservice.com/businessdaily.